In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with my co-hosts Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky.
Howdy.
Hey, you guys.
Hey, Aaron. Who'd you talk to this week?
I talked to Rehan Salam. Rehan is the new executive editor of National Review. I think this is our first conservative politics writer.
You've been trying to get a conservative writer on this show.
I have.
Because I believe this is episode 118, and you have been trying for a long time. I'm proud of you.
I believe in being fair and balanced. But actually, Rehan is like one of the most charming people I have ever talked to in any capacity in my life. I would say politics is actually not the only thing we talked about. He also does a column for Slate. He was the host of Vice's podcast, which I think is no longer a podcast and is now a video show called Vice Meets, but he still hosts it. He's a great interviewer, definitely better at interviewing than any of us. So I really recommend this episode.
Well, it seemed like he got you too. You've seemed much more conservative lately.
I did. I felt like I just wanted to please him after the episode. Do we have any sponsors this week?
We do. We do. We have several sponsors. The first is Bonobos. If you want to please people who are looking at you, you should get some clothes from Bonobos. It's bonobos.com. If you go there and use the code LONGFORM at checkout, you'll get 20% off, and it's free delivery. Check it out, Bonobos.
We are also sponsored this week by one of my favorite games, Cards Against Humanity. But we're actually not sponsored by the game. We're sponsored by Cards Against Humanity's 10 days or whatever of Kwanzaa. So here's how it works. You give Cards Against Humanity $15. They send you 10 mystery gifts for the 10 days or whatever of Kwanzaa. Space is limited to the first 250,000 people who sign up at holidaybullshit.com. I don't think I need to say anything else about that. You're just going to go to holidaybullshit.com right now.
Speaking of sending things out, if you had, let's say, a new political philosophy, like Aaron, you'd become much more conservative. You had a lot of ideas that you wanted to spread to your friends, strangers. Set up an email newsletter.
How would I do that?
The best way to do it, in my opinion, and I learned this by watching you, is a tiny letter from the good people at MailChimp. They're the best place to generate a powerful email newsletter to share with the world.
All right, here we go. Here's Aaron with Rehan Salam.
Welcome, Rehan Salam.
Thank you for having me.
So you are newly the executive editor of National Review.
That is correct.
How newly? This is come last
How couple? Newly? Like literally, I'm in my first week.
This is your first week?
Yes.
So you have been doing this job for a brief enough period that I think you will not be offended by this question where maybe a more senior person might. What does an executive editor do?
That is a very good question, and I think that it's still, you know, I think that you have that title at a bunch of different places, and it means different things at different places.
Yeah.
But Rich Lowry has been our editor for a very long time. He's our editor-in-chief. He oversees both the magazine and the website.
Yeah.
The website is a big, sprawling beast, and I think that just keeping tabs on it is quite an enterprise in itself. So I think that there was a desire to see to it that there's someone at the print magazine who is really focused on the longer articles we put out. We have these three-column and two-column articles in the middle of the book. And just to be sure that we're commissioning thoughtfully, that we're thinking ahead, and that we are also ideally drawing on a wider range of contributors.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, my reputation at NR and with friends has always been as someone who is just very curious about this, always extremely eager to find people, cultivate people in this way, and also to hopefully provoke, to stimulate discussion, to serve the interests of the folks who are part of our core constituency, but then to also connect with people who are outside of that.
I want to come back to certain issues about sort of the differences between the publishing spectrum on the conservative and more progressive end. But when you go look for a young writer, where are the hot spots that are generating young writers that you would be looking for National Review?
The fundamental problem with people in the kind of editorial publishing world, and this is true in ideological media, it's true more broadly as well, is that we find the people who are in our networks or on the fringes of our networks, we tend to identify with people who are broadly similar to us, who share our sensibilities. And I think that's dangerous. I also think that it's a little bit about the kind of person who's drawn to making themselves visible to you.
Yeah.
And I always think of our work as this funny thing because, you know, anyone can write. Not everyone can write well, necessarily, but, you know, there are a lot of people who can do it. So who thinks they can? Who thinks they have something worth saying?
Mm-hmm.
Who is saying that in a place that, you know, will be visible to me or to anyone else? And that's kind of the problem I'm always trying to solve. That being that, you know, I just see these people who are like in my field of vision because they're kind of self-appointed.
Right.
They've appointed themselves as people who ought to be heard. And I just feel like, wow, there are a lot of people out there I want to hear, and I think there are other people who want to hear too, but who aren't really easy to find.
Right. Well, I think that there are certain pockets where there's kind of a farm league system where even someone who doesn't set out to write politically maybe does a few pieces for The All, and someone catches wind of it, and, you know, boom, they're writing for Slate, and someone likes them at Slate, and you're working for the New Republic a few years later. What I've seen, and I may be ignorant of this, is that a magazine like National Review doesn't necessarily have as deep a farm system, that there isn't quite as much of a broad, lowly paid base to choose people from.
That's very astute. So basically, the larger issue is that in our world, I'd say the boundaries between ideological media and non-ideological media are sharper and more distinct than they are with folks who are on the left end of ideological media.
Mm-hmm.
There are many people I know well who started out in ideological media on the left, who then made their way to, leading, I hate the term mainstream media, but, kind of leading prominent media brands.
Sure. Entrenched media.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that, you know, that's a kind of very classic move. And there certainly are some people who are in the kind of right of center universe who've done that too, but it's rare. And some of that reflects the sensibilities of the people in our world. And some of that's just circumstance, like who is in your network, who sees what.
Yeah.
So yeah, where do those people come from? Well, I'll tell you a bit about myself.
Yeah. How would I find you if I were looking for you?
So when I was an undergrad, I was an avid reader of Andrew Sullivan. I was an avid reader of Andrew Sullivan because when I was in high school, I read The New Republic kind of through a random set of circumstances. It was like in my high school library, and I started subscribing to it, and I just got into it. And so I would just email him from time to time when I was an undergrad after he'd started blogging.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very encouraging, and when I applied for an internship in the New Republic, you know, I did that through a separate process, but then he was someone I immediately bonded with. And that was really powerful, partly just, you know, the sense of legitimacy. I mean, I didn't think I was going to be a writer. That was not in the cards for me. That seemed just not like a realistic prospect from someone who came from, you know, standard middle class kind of background. So, you know, just to see how this works, I mean, that was a very big deal for me. But it started out just because I was a curious reader who was just engaging with this person. And I found a lot of people that way.
Yeah.
You know, people who reach out to you, some of whom wind up being really stimulating to talk to. And then, you know, you're kind of at some point you're turning the conversation like, hey, I really appreciate that you're giving me these ideas, but you realize that you actually have a lot to say.
Yeah.
And that, you know, if this is something that you want to do, you ought to do it. It's also, you know, even going to college campuses, finding people who don't necessarily agree with me on X, Y, or Z, but just where it's like, wow, you have an interesting voice. You come from an interesting and distinctive kind of place. Now, again, the tragedy there is just these are college campuses, right? I mean, you know, this is still a fairly narrow slice of the world, but that's really what I get excited about. I really get excited about certainly finding people who think they have a lot to say and are kind of quite happy and comfortable with that, but then sometimes finding people who just have a deep subject expertise or just are compelling storytellers in some other domain and kind of trying to get them excited about some of the questions that I and we're excited about.
Before we started, you and I were having a discussion about whether or not this was a resurgence of the golden age of the columnist. And certainly what you're describing in terms of people with ideas and someone like Sullivan, and I would say your writing is in the tradition of a Sullivan. When you're seeking out for National Review, that sort of that meat of the book stuff that's longer, there's a lot of loud voices on the internet. How do you distill that into something that's a feature? I mean, when I go on National Review's site, it's a lot of columnists. That it's very dominated by sort of opinion blogging. What do you look for in a feature article?
So this relates to the identity of a print magazine in an era in which the web is front-facing, in which the web is how people come to understand us. You know, for example, we call our website National Review Online, and even that's a question internally. Like, you know, it's National Review. I mean, you know, just the idea of it as being this kind of separate thing. And that raises the stakes. So, you know, so then what is the role of the print magazine? So as with many ideological media outlets, you know, our print audience is different from our online audience. It tends to be somewhat older, tends to be very connected to the traditions of the magazine. And I think that that's something that merits respect and attention. I also think, however, that, you know, in a way, the print magazine can have a better relationship to the web product in that it can be about a sensibility. You know, you're attached to this brand, which is why you're subscribing. And so, you know, we're giving you a sense of what to think, what to care about. And so it's stuff that's, you know, less newsy, but feels consequential, feels solid. So for me, a lot of that's been, you know, in the past, just thinking about policy questions. How do we reframe certain policy debates? But in this new role, what I'm hoping is that we can become a place for a lot of rich intra-conservative debate, not just on policy questions, but also on some larger questions too. I mean, my real hope is that, you know, we're both going to say things that are going to resonate with our audience, but also some things that are going to challenge that audience and also hopefully spur some dissension, you know, kind of richer conversation kind of within our community. But then also, you know, Kevin Williamson, one of our writers, who's one of the favorites of our readers, he wrote a really wonderful story about Appalachia a little while ago.
Yeah, that was on long form. It was awesome.
And what was wonderful about that is just that it was something that I think it was introducing some of our readers to a slice of the country that they're not necessarily familiar with. But it was also something that was connecting to people who are not normally coming to National Review, to the print magazine. And that's exciting to me. I definitely want to find that kind of storytelling. I want to do things that are challenging. And so, you know, as to kind of what constitutes a feature, I mean, because I came of age with that Andrew Sullivan New Republic, that is not something that we've always done, but like the takedown or just the thing that's like, you know, kind of taking on a larger idea that's a little diffuse and giving it some definition. That's one thing that we can do that is sharper and it's going to be witty. But then also things that are reported and bringing something new to our readers. So again, you know, we're not in the business of breaking stories at the print magazine. Hopefully that's something we'll be doing with our website. But just the idea that, you know, we're opening people up to some of the intricacies, some of the kind of inside details, like how does the sausage get made? Telling compelling stories about that as well, I think would be very exciting.
Well, I think it's interesting. I really want to avoid like saying like the other side of ideological media does this. How come you don't do that? Or like, why do you do this? But that said, the New Republic will run, and it's not just the New Republic. Someone will run an investigation of the Koch brothers or an environmental issue that is sort of loosely aligned with a certain progressive ideological value, but is also just, wow, this is a great story. You know, we dug up a great story, and I'm interested in whether you see the same opportunities sort of going the other direction, looking at, you know, major Democratic donors or policy issues. Like, I want them to be balanced so that in my job as sort of a curator of the internet, I'm like, I want to be like column A, column B. Everyone gets a fair shot. And I often find that conservative journalism doesn't counterweight that kind of a piece, and I'm always curious why.
That is a very interesting question, and I do think that that is changing. So, for example, if you look at the Washington Free Beacon, this is a website that does very aggressive reporting. They do a lot of work on donors. They've done a ton of work on Tom Steyer, a very prominent donor to Democratic and environmental causes. I think that, you know, there's a lot of value to that, and I think that there's more of this culture of aggressive investigative reporting. But, you know, another issue is just resources. So there's a woman, Helen Andrews, who used to go by the name Helen Riddlemeyer. She used to work at NR for a while, and she just has a great eye. She's not my biggest fan, which is kind of why I like her, actually. She's someone who really calls bullshit on people. Yeah. And I remember she wrote something about conservative media a while ago. And again, I'm very new to this role, but I think that it kind of raised some really solid points. I mean, we face resource constraints. And so to some degree, and I think this is true of ideological media more broadly, but you know, this is certainly true of us, a lot of the people who write for us are people who are just delighted to be writing for us. They're people who are in the think tank world, academics, people who are activists, you know, people who we think have really distinctive, exciting voices. But they are not people, you know, for whom it's viable or possible for them to spend, you know, 6 months chasing a story. And also, we don't, we haven't always had the resources to be able to make those stories a kind of going proposition. I mean, you know, as in the kind of left of center world, I mean, there are various fellowships. There are things that are kind of making this more possible, and one hopes to do a somewhat better job of that. But again, it's also like, it's the permeability. It's kind of like, what do you think your role is? And I think that to some degree, folks on my side of the street, I actually joke about this with some of my writers, some of the people that I'm reaching out to now, like, hey, just don't do what I do. Like, you know, what I did is I wrote manifestos. Let me tell you what I think about X.
Right.
And in a way, like, that's cool. I obviously do it all the time. And I think that, you know, there's a place for it. But yeah, I do think that simply diagnosis. Yeah, we have certain values. We have principles. We have gut instincts that we share or that, you know, we debate at the edges. But then there's also just the diagnosis question. Like, what actually is going on? What's wrong out there? And actually, are we right about that? Like, one thing I've been intrigued by is that I think many conservatives have this attitude that, well, America is fundamentally a conservative country. And, you know, gosh, that's why it's such an outrage when things are going in this direction or whatever else. And, you know, one thing I'm just intrigued by is, you know, what if that's not the case? Peter Beinart wrote a piece for National Journal a few months ago that got a little bit of attention about how America is a more secular society. It's less exceptional in some respects. And to some degree, that could be an exciting pose for us. I mean, or certainly, you know, I can see that being a font for a certain kind of argument that, well, actually, no, the country isn't actually where we are, and we want to get the country to where we are. And there's a kind of vitality to that kind of argument where you just kind of don't take for granted some of these things that a lot of us do. So I'm excited about that. And that can't always be done through, let me, you know, tell you what I think, like the classic Raihan style opinion
sort
of thing.
He's doing a beard stroking motion, right?
my fake beard. Instead, just, yeah, let's do that diagnosis and let's persuade people by telling compelling stories.
Hey, it's your host, Aaron Lammer, with a quick word from our sponsor, Bonobos. Winter is coming. Perhaps you want to update your wardrobe, but you don't want the hassle of shopping for it. That's the situation I was in, and I was very excited to discover Bonobos. They're at bonobos.com. They make everything from shirts to hats to denim, outerwear, pretty much anything you could want. So I encourage you to go to bonobos.com, and when you're checking out, put in offer code LONGFORM. You'll get 20% off your first order. Shipping's always free both ways, and you can return anything if you don't love it, no questions asked. It's extremely easy. So go to bonobos.com, that's B-O-N-O-B-O-S.com, because you deserve to look your best, and these guys will help you with that. Here I am back with Rehan Salam. You host a, it's labeled a podcast, or maybe it was once labeled a podcast. I think it's been rebranded now. It was originally the Vice Podcast. And one of my favorite, I really enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed, you had Rick MacArthur, who's the publisher of Harper's. You disagreed with some of his views, but Rick MacArthur is probably of magazine publishers the most tilted against the internet of anyone who's got a major mouthpiece right now. And I was very impressed when I was watching you interview him that I got the impression that you disagreed with his views without you ever disagreeing with him. Like, you have a real skill at being a neutral interviewer, yet still not sort of getting bowled over. And I'm guessing that this somewhat comes down to you're someone who's frequently in the presence of people whose views differ strongly from your own. Like, when I met you, we were at a picnic table. I fairly confident on the political views of the other people at the table, not you. And I think that's an unusual experience in America right now, to be so comfortable among people who, is that something that you have worked on, have cultivated? I know that's a loaded question.
No. I love interviewing people. And I think that part of what draws me to this line of work is I care about politics. I think of myself as having an activist bent. I care about the country. I care about the country's future. And so it matters to me to be with people who are like-minded and to be working together, feeling like we're working together in the same direction. Mm-hmm. So that stuff is very, very important to me. But I also think the thing that has always drawn me to being a reader is I'm incredibly curious about other people. I'm curious about what they think of as the constraints operating on their lives.
Yeah.
Why do they think what they think? And I think that, you know, with the interview series, it's really important to me just to draw out what they think and to, you know, make them feel safe in that. And, you know, there are times when I kind of will push back, but usually the pushback is just to gain some more clarity into exactly how they put the pieces together. But, like, in a way, if I weren't doing this job, I'd want to be a high school guidance counselor, because I'm obsessed with the idea that there are people who think that there are constraints operating on their lives. A lot of these constraints are real. Some people don't see the constraints, you know, or whatever else, but it's just, but some of these constraints, they're plastic. You know, to some degree, it depends on how we think of ourselves in relation to other people and what we can do. And I just kind of feel like, wow, what a powerful thing. What a difficult, hard, and miserable job in some ways. But just to feel like you can be the person who can kind of reframe how people think about stuff. Some people think of opinion journalism as about persuasion. And I actually don't think that's the case, because I think that it can be at the edge, but I think it's very hard to persuade people, because people believe, at our age, I mean, you and I are both ancient, we're practically dead.
Yes.
But, you know, we believe things because we're affiliated with people. For me to tell you that you're wrong about this, like, deep foundational thing is for me to tell you that your mom is wrong, you know, your whole family is wrong, where you grew up, that whole thing is wrong. I mean, I'm not going to persuade you of that.
Right.
What I can persuade you of, and this is in terms of my engagement with things outside of my world, I can persuade you that actually some people who disagree with you are actually coming from the exact same kind of place. They're actually pretty thoughtful. Maybe you'll think, well, you're entrenched in this other thing and I'm not. I'm actually deeply thoughtful. Or maybe just to make you think twice about that. And that's one thing that kind of loosens the thought process a little bit. And again, I don't think I'm going to persuade people that way, but I can challenge them and get them to be a little clearer about exactly what it is they think. And I think that there's a lot of value to that. So, you know, in my writing, in my own columns and what have you, I mean, I'm very cognizant of the fact that you're doing different jobs for different people. I'm doing one job. There's some people who are like, I'm coming to Raihan because I basically agree with Raihan and I kind of, you know, want to see him make a, you know, a certain kind of argument. Then there are other people who are like, I like to get angry and enraged and I'm literally just going to read this so that I could become full of hate. And happy to do that too. And there are going to be, you know, some kind of people fall in some third category, et cetera. And, you know, you just need to appreciate these are different constituencies. But how can you leave everyone a little bit better off?
Yep.
Like, how that person who really wants to get enraged, I guess you can, you know, kind of stir the blood a bit and, you know, kind of, you know, get them thinking and get them to believe what they already believe even more so. And the people who kind of are just curious and open, you could hopefully show them something new or give them a different frame to understand things they think they already understand. So, you know, that to me has always been very fun and satisfying.
So I was going to ask you about activism, the idea of activism, and what you were saying about sort of stirring up people's preconceptions. When you write a piece, there's potentially the way that you would just write it in a vacuum to your own tastes, to your own beliefs. And then there's what impact it will have on another person. And I think that in the last couple of years, some of the stuff that's happened on the web, when you look at a company like, say, Upworthy, that is really testing how people react to a headline, how people react to an image. In a couple of years, you're really going to be able to fine-tune that idea of activism, the impact of what your writing could have. And I guess I'm wondering, how do you balance those two things, sort of your ideal of an article versus what would be convincing to someone or even would get clicked on by someone? And it, or is that something that just doesn't matter to you?
I wear a lot of different hats, and I think that I do approach things differently depending on which hat that I'm wearing. So, for example, in terms of engaging with people who are in the wider world, you know, that is people who are non-conservatives, let's say, I mean, persuasion is not, you know, my chief mode of operating. When I'm within my world, and I think that National Review has done a very good job of this, we really do, I mean, you know, we have these staff editorials where we, it really does matter to us to an audience of people who are broadly like-minded, but to kind of say that, hey, look, here are our shared ideals and values, and here's how to think about this. And our editor, Rich Lowry, is someone who I think has long been very deeply interested in the idea that, you know, conservatism needs to be centered on the interests of working-class Americans. And to some degree, we fail to do the work of diagnosis, that there are many people in our world who don't fully understand what's happening on the ground, how families have changed, how durable these changes are. So I think that, you know, that activism piece is very important in that sense of just within our world, you know, how do we make this case? How do we articulate a conservatism that fits the realities of our country as it is right now. Now, as for the kind of content that we're producing outside of those staff editorials, I think that part of it is that actually it is a fairly big tent, and there are people who have, and we actually have always, you know, some would say to a fault, really allowed these debates to unfold. You know, people have deep disagreements about, you know, any number of questions, immigration policy, you know, how to think about political Islam, like just, you know, all kinds of things. And I think that that's healthy for us to be the site of that kind of interconservative debate. You know, when you talk about Upworthy, I mean, gosh, that is deeply interesting because this also relates to political communication and opinion media. Like, this is one thing that I find interesting because I think that, you know, people will always complain about, you know, gosh, resources. And I kind of, you know, invoked, you know, this question in terms of how it shapes, you know, kind of some of the journalism we've done or how we've kind of approached things. But the thing is that in a way, political communication is a huge industry.
Yeah.
And that is something that is separate and distinct from what we do. And there are ways in which those lines blur. So, you know, you have many nonprofits, many think tanks that are producing content. And they're producing, and actually, you know, kind of many of these guys are trying to do investigative stuff.
A lot of people who write for National Review have also written a piece for a think tank.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And also when you think about, you know, some of the most talented left liberals, neoliberals, you know, who are kind of in the opinion journalism world are people who had their stints at Think Progress or had their stints. It's, you know, quite striking. And so, you know, when you talk about the ecology where people come from, you know, it is very interesting. And I think that some of these guys do think very explicitly and, you know, about effective political communication. But I mean, to some degree, that's about the audiences. Political communication is trying to connect with this much larger universe of people who, like, maybe pay attention
right
before an election. So I think that, you know, we live in that world more of that core of people who have, you know, this kind of civic commitment that happens to kind of line up with partisan politics. So I do think that those are somewhat different things. And I think that, you know, in a way, you know, we make a mistake not having a very precise sense of who we're talking to. Michael Kelly, late editor of The Atlantic, but he always talked about how, you know, when he was talking to advertisers, he was trying to tell them that, you know, the Atlantic reader is a CEO, whereas, you know, the truth was that The Atlantic reader is someone who just likes reading books and is probably kind of a nerd. Now, you know, that's not necessarily as sexy to advertisers, but, you know, it's people who are stimulated by this, and oftentimes people who are very much like the people who are kind of, you know, producing, you know, what we're putting out.
It seems like for me, to do your job, you have to be a very active reader. So how do you stay on top of all this stuff so that you can come out with something every week and not look like an asshole?
Well, one thing is you give up on not looking like an asshole because you definitely just will. So you just kind of accept that that's your inevitable fate. But I think, well, I used to use an RSS reader, and then the RSS reader really felt like a job.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, now I do use tools like Longform and Pocket that are enormously helpful because, you know, and you'll find this with a lot of people, you know, Twitter becomes something that is a very useful source for just harvesting.
Sure.
Oh, gosh, that, you know, kind of, that makes sense. I need to follow up on that. And I do read print magazines. I certainly read the London Review of Books, you know, and kind of like just, I don't know, like even like Raritan, you know, kind of this random stuff, just because it's things that are not organically, you know, kind of coming across my field of vision.
You're one of the rare people who can actually claim that you're like using an RSS reader for work.
Like, yeah. Yeah. I mean, but I think that, you know, it's also just kind of, I follow my curiosity. I mean, I think that I'm someone who like harvests books, like, and I'm not proud of it, but like, you know, kind of, so, you know, there are some books I'll read in a sustained kind of way, you know, kind of a little bit of fiction here and there, like you, I imagine, you know, kind of just given where we are, where we live, like we know a fair number of writers, so that creates its own obligations. But
there's certain people you have to at least like be convincingly
right
that you have read their books. Yeah.
But a lot of books I consume electronically to just kind of pour through them and actually like to go through their footnotes, you know, and also just to kind of find other stuff like that. So that's something that is very satisfying. And also just, you know, some of what I do is, yeah, just kind of like reading columns that I feel like, gosh, this could go in this other direction. And I kind of want to know if this person feels the same way. So for me, some of it now is like, there's definitely like reading. But one thing I like about this job is that it's kind of an excuse for me to do the thing that I've always loved to do, which is talk to people and just like, hey, why did you make this choice? You know, like, or tell me, like, as someone who writes myself, I know this isn't exactly what you wanted to say. So like, what is the thing you exactly wanted to say, where you needed to kind of boil it down to this thing? That's a whole separate and interesting question. But in a way, each generation has its own conventions of how it does opinion media. And I think that we're in a moment where a certain style of argument that is very data-driven has become very pervasive and is very admired. You know, it's certainly something that I've been amenable to and I think is important and valuable. But I sometimes also just think, like, Lionel Trilling didn't use charts. And he said, like, I remember, you know, there's that cover story a little while ago, you know, about the Ivy League and why the Ivy League is turning out just kind of miserable drones. And it just stimulated enormous conversation. It was, and then there are these people, well, I don't see your proof. There's just a lot of assertions in here, Buster. Yeah. And it's like, dude, I mean, yes, but like, does it resonate? Does it not? And actually, and that's a legitimate way to engage with this. Like, actually, let's look at what the data tells us. And by the way, the data tells us very little. I mean,
right. You know, or it's this data, not that data. Or
yeah, absolutely.
There's usually enough to take it a few different
directions.
That's
not to say that, you know, it's not important. God, I mean, the fact that there's still, you still learn new things by looking in an obvious place.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's amazing. You know, we've had a conversation for decades about single parenthood, but now it's also like, well, actually, intentional pregnancies versus unplanned, that's a whole other dimension that's really rich. So like, I love data. I think it's really important. I think there's so much more to be done with it. But then I also think just arguments that are rooted in experience are also very valuable. And frankly, I adhere to those conventions. I adhere to those conventions of like, well, you know, you will take me seriously because I'm kind of citing these things and it matters to me and I think it's important. But I happen to love myself. And that's kind of why I gravitate to that sometimes in my reading, because like the fire hose I'm consuming is all this stuff that's like frankly very similar, oftentimes like near identical. So when I read things that are coming from like left field and from like a very distinctive way of thinking, I love it.
See, okay, I don't love it, and I want to, and that let's talk that through. So, sort of a put down of a lot of this kind of writing is sort of the hot take, right? You got a bunch of people zigging this way, saying higher education is worthless. So, I'm going to be the guy who's like saying higher education is worth more than it's ever been, right?
Yeah.
I've seen you on your feet. I feel like I could throw it, like lob you a topic and go like, go over, go under,
right,
go over.
Right.
And you could do a really good job. Like there's like a high school debate element to it where it's like either I'm getting assigned a side or I'm just going to take the side that I find the most interesting that would bring the most traffic. And media is getting broader and broader. So there's more and more, like if more and more people are writing about the same topic, someone's got to go for the hot take, and then someone's got to go for the super hot take.
Right.
And very soon, we're saying things that we might not mean. I guess I'm wondering like how that kind of writing intersects with more and more people writing online for free and sort of trying to carve out their own space. Like, do you feel crowded in? You know, when you do your Slate column, you're like, God damn it, all these other people already done their columns. I got to like wedge in this crowded train.
No, but I mean, I think that actually, you bring us this. So actually, I think that when I'm talking about these things that are a little bit different and distinct in this way, So William Derisovitz, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but he...
Damn, I was hoping you knew it, and then now I would know how to say it.
So he is someone who had this long experience of teaching. Now, I have to say, I actually do disagree with him very deeply on a lot of his core premises about the world. It is true that he was drawing on this kind of rich and long experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I actually don't even think he necessarily got it right, but I think there are certain kinds of critiques, quote unquote, of, you know, kind of what he did that just don't kind of pass muster for me. Well, and actually, that's a whole other issue. My friend Jay Kang talks about this a lot.
Check out his long form podcast.
Very, very talented man. But, you know, he often talks about this idea that, you know, there's a reason why on the internet, the things that flourish are, I don't necessarily want to hear what Raihan has to say about Ferguson. I want to hear what a young African-American kid living in Ferguson has to say about it. And that's something that the web allows us to do that's actually really, really impressive and new. And now, you know, then what can I say? So I wrote a column around that time that was like very loosely, like barely, but, you know, but to me actually felt relevant. And it was just about low-rise working class communities with non-traditional families. And it was like a very simple premise, and the idea was just there's this built environment of American suburbia that co-evolved with a certain kind of family, a certain type of family that is actually a lot less common in many of these communities. And that itself creates all kinds of really interesting tensions. It creates public policy problems. Like, okay, why do you have these towns where, you know, they're charging everyone insane fines? And, you know, well, you know, because actually there's something fundamentally unviable about the economics of some of these communities in terms of like how much infrastructure they have versus how many people they have, just some stuff like that. And it's one of these things where like there is some that's known about this. There are some things that are like hard pieces of evidence, but there are other things that are a bit impressionistic that are argument driven. And, you know, to some extent, you're weaving these things together. Now, for someone who is a kind of contrarian or someone who, like, you know, as you've identified in my world as a conservative, you know, among people who are not conservatives, you know, there's a way in which I often feel like I'm taking facts about the world, but I'm saying, hey, actually, the way that everyone understands them is not necessarily the right way to understand them. I can assemble these facts in a way that is telling a different story that I think is more compelling. Now, there's no way to adjudicate this other than, does this resonate with your experience or not? And that's a big part of what I love to do.
Yeah.
Because I think that just so many people are like, well, those are the facts. And like, ergo, I mean, it's like, wow, but you realize that your understanding of these facts is embedded in things that you're not always making explicit. There are certain like moral understandings or just prejudices or whatever else that, you know, kind of govern how you think. And also, one thing that certainly happens in public conversations is people are always trying to regulate the domain in which the conversation can take place. So they're like, well, your framework is just wrong because it's so obviously offensive. Let's say that it like can't possibly be right. So ergo, you must compete with me like in my narrow turf. It's like, oh, that's interesting that you've done that. I'm not going to go along with that, but thanks for trying. You know what I mean? Right. Like that's, you know, and that's actually relates to, you know, the people that I'm trying to draw into the magazine. And by the way, one of my ulterior motives for doing this is that I assume that a lot of the people listening to your podcast are people who are themselves writers who care about good writing. And I just want people to know, like, come to me.
You want to say your email address on the air? Is that overkill?
Sure.
this could backfire horribly.
It is my first initial, then it is my last name, at the magazine where I'm based, .com.
You just set up a fairly high bar
for
figuring that one out.
Exactly.
Okay, so I find your defense of that kind of vigorous debate interesting, although I still find it like viscerally sometimes unpleasant to be around. I guess I feel like it when we ram so many of these conflicts together, there's a certain person who's me who becomes sort of politically disinterested because I'm not really I'm not an activist and I'm not a fighter. Do you feel like there's a role for a person who wants to read about this stuff, but like outrage?
Oh yeah.
What you were saying.
Well, Aaron, I'm not sure we do disagree because I think part of what I'm saying is that when you're doing this thing where you're changing the framework, what you're doing is you're getting out of the like immediate like bipolar confrontation.
Right.
You know what I mean? You're like trying to take it to a different place. But what you're doing is like you are saying things that where, you know, they're not simply right or wrong.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're things that actually hopefully people are going to be chewing over and reflecting on. If you're telling me that like a lot of stuff on the internet is really tiresome because people are lazy or you know, that's clearly, clearly true.
I think me and Wesley Morris, you know, we had like the exact same discussion, except instead of it being about like political writing, it was about like the hot take as it pertains to like, are we only going to talk about rape when there's been like a rape on Game of Thrones? Like, what, pop culture becomes this vessel for discussing serious issues, and it's like, we can only talk about them through the lens of these like Twitter events. And I thought his defense, what he said was somewhat similar to what you said. He was like, well, those people are just bad at it. Like, there's a good version of this and there's a bad version of it. And what I'm trying to do is the good version.
So,
of
like, Huashu says that one of the reasons he finds sports so compelling is that professional sports is how Americans talk about commerce, race, power. It's how they talk about so many things. And if you are attuned to pro sports, you just get access to this enormous universe.
Absolutely.
You know, one of my favorite writers, Mina Kimes, has recently left Bloomberg to go to ESPN to be a columnist, which is like a big change because she was someone who wrote like long form investigative stories about skullduggery in the business world that were incredible. But
since there's no way to do an audio hyperlink, check out her long form podcast.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Which she talks about the story you just.
And I can see why people find that so compelling. Now, I will say separately, tangentially, that I do kind of worry about the brain drain to sports just because, you know, as much as I enjoy sports myself, boy, you have this really interesting imbalance in which sports media has this like megalith. It has like the Death Star that is ESPN because like that's the one thing people don't TiVo. And just the fact that they're able to, I mean, it is really interesting now. You know, I'm not sure how that's going to work out, but yeah, I mean, I'm with Wesley in the sense that, Wesley Morris, in the sense that that's where the culture is. That's where we have shared conversations, and I think that's okay. Now, on the other hand, I am obviously quite happy talking to the niche audience of people. Like when I type in my phone, et cetera, it autocorrects to EITC for the Earned Income Tax Credit, which I think tells you a little bit about the depth of my like niche interests. I mean, I think that clearly I'm emailing my friends about the EITC and what we think about it. Going back to the activist thing, this smaller audience is oftentimes of the people who are engaged with the making of policy, and it's informing how they think about these underlying issues, and that has real consequences. And that's something that I feel a great responsibility towards, you know, just that we are informing people who are making very important decisions and also just kind of helping them navigate, well, what do you trust or how do I understand this? What's the diagnosis? And, you know, as in medicine, diagnosis is an art more than a science.
You said that one of your techniques was to sort of take the argument out of the box, take it out of its sort of most basic constraints. And I think that's something you're very skilled at, not just in the sense of debate or also, you know, when you're hosting the Vice podcast as a moderator, you'll have these guests where it's like Jeremy Scahill and then Reggie Watts and then Stoya, who's a porn actress. And then, you know, it's a real diversity of people. And I think that you're good at those shows actually have a thread. They don't feel like, wow, these are totally different than each other. How do you do that? Like, what are your techniques for drawing something out of its, you know, traditional box and bringing it somewhere where you feel like there's a valuable discussion to be had?
Among my friends, a running joke is just that I'm someone who always asks people questions. I wouldn't say it's compulsive, but I just love to get to know the people around me. And I guess I always think of it as just respect. Like, I've done very little celebrity journalism in my life, but the thing that has always been, there's this funny indignity to it. You're the worst part of this person's day, or you're just kind of this burden. You're this obstacle to be overcome, you know, by this person who would desperately want to be somewhere else. So I always think just being able to connect with something, with someone, and just figuring out, you know, what is it that this person cares about, wants to say. And it's hard, actually. Like, I definitely feel with some people, like, they're primed for this and they have things they want to share or ways they want to be seen. They have ways they're normally seen, and then they have this other way they want to be seen. There's this other missing dimension to kind of their public persona. And that's how I always think about it. Just like respect, like, you know, how can I bring out how you think things fit together and how you think your agenda or whatever is, or whatever you've put, you know, kind of, you know, recently I interviewed Alex Ross Perry, the director of Listen Up, Philip, a really, really good movie, and Jason Schwartzman.
Really, and a surprisingly non-promo-ish interview you did with him.
But I was just so curious about this movie. And just for me, it was like, you've made this thing that is, I think, so rich and just so much thought went into this. And it was amazing because, like, right off the bat, he was, like, telling me things that, yeah, people react to it in this way. I can't control how people react to it, but that is definitely not what I think. And, you know, kind of people were making assumptions about how he thought, how he approached his characters. And I was like, this is perfect. This is exactly what I want to know.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, that's, like, everything. Like, and that's the thing about ideology, too. It's like, boy, I mean, I definitely encounter people who think they know what I'm about. They think they know where I'm from. You know, it's obviously, like, kind of offensive or just kind of whatever. Or sometimes not. Or sometimes, like, it's actually more generous than is appropriate. Or any person who's, like, even semi-public. So just to get that feeling of, like, really getting to know people who think something, like, deeply different from you or have this really different kind of experience, what a privilege. And I think that's a privilege that, you know, you and I have as people who, you know, get to be readers for a lot of our life.
Absolutely. And interviewer. I mean, I'm asking you questions about interviewing, and I'm very sincerely, like, trying to, like, steal your techniques. So, like, one of the things you said that was that people have this perceived self, and then almost everyone has this secret self or this what they really want to be known for or what they really want to be asked. How do you sniff for that secrets? How do you get on the trail of what that is when someone comes in and you've never met them before?
I have always believed that everyone wants to be seen. Everyone wants to be recognized. There's this amazing Doris Lessing quote in which she talks about how women, young women in our culture, are put on display. They're incredibly visible. And then suddenly, without warning, you enter this other phase of life where you become invisible. And she just talks about how that's actually a gift. Just, you know, the way you get this space to be yourself. Or, I mean, I'm butchering it, but it's a beautiful and affecting quote. And I've thought about it so much. But a lot of what I think about is that, yeah, that's an experience for some people who are so visible and then they just cease to become visible. But then there are some people who are never visible. You know, I always think about, like, why is our line of work full of men who look like gargoyles? Or oddballs or kind of whatever else. And it's just, you know, when I was talking at the beginning of our conversation just about these people who, like, feel like they really need to be heard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a coincidence that these are a lot of people who've had to put effort into being heard and actually, to some extent, that's actually quite beautiful.
Yeah.
There are people who are like, I need to assert myself because I'm invisible otherwise. And, like, I think of it, you know, my mother is a woman in her late 60s. And I always think, like, anyone who sees her on the subway, they would have certain ideas about her based on how she's dressed or, you know, how tired she looks or whatever else. But it's like, you have no idea how much she knows, what she thinks, what her inner life is like, how crazy and interesting she is. And just so, I guess for me, like, I'm just like, whenever I'm in a room like that, just like everyone, like, wow, like everyone has this story, like, and we're our bodies are passing each other. And it's like, whoa, it's just like so heavy. You know, for me, politics was a way for me to talk about human beings, how they interact with institutions, and about values, like about, you know, kind of what I think are, like, the virtues we should be cultivating. And, you know, how institutions constrain and narrow our lives, and how we can make them better. But the real root of this all is just, yeah, like anyone, like, you know, your own feelings of invisibility, and then just kind of how amazing it is to feel recognized, and then to know that that's true for other people too. So I think of it as just being attuned to recognizing what, not just wanting to say stuff, but just giving people that space to show who they really are.
It's interesting that you bring up your mother as an example of someone who would have a preconception about that would be missing a deep inner life. Your parents are Bangladeshi immigrants, is
that
right?
That's right.
Do you feel like your experience as someone who has a fairly recent immigrant heritage, do you feel like your own experience, those preconceived notions, have had a large effect on your life? And has that, you know, made that something you think about as you go about your daily life in New York City?
I think about this a lot in terms of Black identity. This is kind of a random thing to say, but I often think about the high school I attended, which had many, many Asian students and very few African-American students.
But where did
I
you
went to Stuyvesant High School.
Stuyvesant, okay.
And, you know, I sometimes think about the ways in which, because the Black experience is such a central part of American history and culture, the weight of Black identity for those who are, let's say, Black in majority non-Black environments. Whereas for me, I think that a lot of it's happenstance. A lot of it's literally just when I happen to have been born. There wasn't a super rigid, firm script for people like me. And so I think that gave me a fair bit of freedom. There were scripts around class. There are many other things. But also, like, you know, I didn't have a Brooklyn accent. I mean, I'm from Brooklyn, but, and, you know, it's not that I'm proud of that or not proud of that, but it just happened to be you were treated differently because of it. And I became very attuned to this early. And I think I became very attuned to how unfair it was early.
Yeah.
But also just about how you navigate this world. And, you know, fairness is one way of understanding the world. But another way to understand it is just, yeah, these are constraints that are real and you navigate them and you have some agency. You don't have as, and different people have more and others have less. And just also seeing my parents and the constraints they operated under and, you know, that being very present for me. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that drew me to thinking a lot about just American history. How did we wind up here? Like, you know, kind of like, who are these people? And just trying to form a community out of these people with these really different. Another thing I sometimes think is that, you know, I do think a lot about immigration. I write a lot about it. I probably write about it more than I ought to, just because I'm sure people get bored by it. But there are all of these narratives, like, you know, kind of either all immigrants are saints or they're all criminals and hoodlums. I mean, it's just, it's very weird the way we talk about this, like, large class of people. And my views on immigration are very different from, you know, most of the people that I know here in New York, different from my co-ethnics, let's say. There are very few Bangladeshi Americans, well, period, very few people of Bangladeshi origin who become citizens of the United States. But I did see that 96% of Bangladeshi Americans voted for Barack Obama, which I thought was, you know, pretty impressive. So, yeah, I mean, this is definitely something I think a lot about. But I think that it probably is true that the way other people see me through like a kind of racial script has informed their thinking. I haven't felt that personally burdened by it. And I'm very cognizant of not being as burdened by it as people from, you know, many other backgrounds, where the associations that people have with a certain group identity, even just thinking about like, you know, the proverbial, like, you know, douchebag, you know what I mean? Like, you know, that's another thing that kind of weirdly carries with it a lot of weight. And when you kind of go into certain settings, so that hasn't felt like, you know, like something that has been that oppressive to me. It's felt more like an opportunity. You know, I a lot of people, you know, of my background, you know, there's this running thing about people asking you, so where are you from? No, where are you really from? And I think that, you know, this whole idea that that's actually like a microaggression, it's really annoying. And I don't dismiss that. I think that there are contexts in which that can be pretty obnoxious. But I've always thought of it as, well, I will tell you where I'm from. I'm from Brooklyn. But my parents are from, I will like preemptively answer the question.
Yeah.
And I think you want to know something about me or like where I'm coming from or like what my deal is. And if that's it, like, I'm actually happy to talk about it. But I also want to know about you because, like, I'm not going to assume that you're a blank. Like,
right.
I'm going to assume that you are embedded in something. Like, I'm going to assume that, oh, you're white and you went to Haverford, but, oh, you're from Erie, Pennsylvania, and, oh, you grew up in a trailer park, and, oh, and, like, you feel pretty alienated from a lot of the people you grew up around. Like, that's really interesting, and I want to know about that. So in a way, like, we all have an ethnicity, and I just kind of feel like, so for me, it's like an opportunity to like give people a safe space to have a conversation about like who they think they are.
And I guess I'm wondering, that sort of curiosity that you have for other people, how do you do that transaction in a way that's non-threatening to people? Like, you have a real ease with coming back on a statement, as you said, that is sort of offensive in its basic origin and turning it into a discussion.
Most of the time, I think it's just genuine curiosity. And to some degree, actually, there are certain people who are in certain cultural environments who know not to ask that question.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's like, I almost think that's kind of worse because like, if you want to know, but so you grew up in Berkeley, I grew up in Brooklyn,
you know,
a kind of similar community in some ways.
What part of Brooklyn did you grow up in?
I grew up in Borough Park. And then I grew up in Kensington. Borough Park, which is now a very heavily Hasidic neighborhood, was at the time, but is more so now. And Kensington, which is, you know, pretty mixed, you know, at the time, kind of.
You've got to be like dynamite on
directions. Middle class. I know my way around decently. But so I guess the way that I always think of it is that I grew up in a culture where I grew up in an environment where everyone was ethnic.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of the white people I knew were Jewish, pretty much. I mean, not quite, but close to it. Or they were kind of, you know, quote unquote white ethnics who were people who definitely had a real sense of place or had a sense of grievance or kind of, you know, whatever else. And, you know, I grew up among a lot of immigrants and children of immigrants. And I sometimes think about this because in a weird way, I think that my failures of empathy, and like everyone, I have them, sometimes in a weird way are for people who are like me. Or in some sense like me, or one would understand them to be like me, because let's say it's someone who's like an East Asian person who grew up in like an all-white environment and kind of, you know, feels very marked and very visible for that reason, not in a good way. Whereas I think that, you know, because of where I grew up, I actually weirdly was like, hey, you guys are all prejudiced against these white Christian guys, you know, or something like that. So in a funny way, that was actually a way for me to connect very closely with American identity, because I felt I knew that there were racists. I encountered racism, but it was kind of like, what are you going to do? Throw us out?
Yeah.
You know, like, we're heavily armed and aggressive and ornery. I mean, you get it. It's like, you know, like, actually, of course we have a right to be here. I mean, it's hard to explain, but it was like a different kind of attitude that maybe led me to respect or be more comfortable with conservative constituencies even before I thought of myself as a conservative. But in a way, then I try to think about people who are kind of like in some sense like me but under different circumstances and trying to understand where they come from. And I think that that actually is a real struggle for conservatives more broadly. It's really striking because when you look at Asian Americans voted overwhelmingly for President Obama's reelection, but it's striking because actually it seems that religion has a lot to do with it. If you're an Asian American Christian, you're more likely to identify with the political right than if you're, let's say, a Hindu or a Muslim or a Buddhist. And that's really interesting to me, the idea of like this anxiety being not just about race, but also about this kind of religious culture.
It's interesting. We were talking about like college students and like whether they're ever going to get print magazines. I'm coming down on the no on that one. But it's also print magazines are just one of many issues where if you believe that people who are, say, 18 to 22 now are the future of America, which I think if you're like running a political party, that's kind of something you got to be keeping your eye on. There's all of these things that print magazines, marijuana legalization, there are these issues that there's no anti-marijuana base in the 18 to 22 year old. There are these issues that are dying out with people. It's strange even to be having a debate about some of these issues. As someone who's like planning to like live like 40 more years, I'm like, oh, do we have to have this like medical marijuana debate? It's over. All we have to do is wait till all these people like get 10 years older. Is that a false idea?
I think you're wrong. Yeah. I mean, I think that marijuana is an issue I've thought about a lot. I mean, the regulation of marijuana specifically. Oregon, for example, has a proposition on the ballot, yep. You know, this fall. Now, again, partly it could be the demographics of the electorate in a midterm, but it's quite possible it's going to lose. And if it wins, it is going to put in place a regime that is going to cause a lot of problems for Washington State and for other neighboring states, potentially. So we could agree at this level, but then where the rubber meets the road, I mean, right. I think there are a lot of interesting, tricky questions. And also, like, I think that in terms of the public opinion of younger people, there are some issues where I think that, you know, kind of, you know, these debates have solidly changed. There are others where we are going to see this stuff fluctuate. I mean, there is this poll from the Harvard Institute of Politics, and it was really fascinating because the disapproval for the president is quite high. A majority of these millennial voters want a Republican-led Congress. You know, I was surprised by a fair bit of this. And, you know, there's a way in which actually people who are substantially younger than us are growing up with a different set of narratives about how the world works and, you know, perhaps about overreach and these kinds of things. And I do think that that's something that keeps me up at night. I mean, something that I'm nervous about. Are we doing a good enough job, we at National Review, the people in my world more broadly, of connecting to this? And that goes back to diagnosis. Like, to what extent do we even understand this world? Because one challenge that people on the right face, conservatives and Republicans face, is that the people within these constituencies are more likely to be in intact families, let's say. They're more likely to be in communities that are defined by a high level of homogeneity, et cetera. So in a way, they don't always appreciate how much the country has changed. Mm-hmm. But then it is also true that there are many younger people for whom conservative ideas do resonate. But there has to be a process of translation and actually kind of really understanding. You know, they might be open to you, but you have to be relevant to their lives. So I don't see a lot of these debates as settled. I do think the debates are going to be different. And I think that's really important. Like, yeah, like where, so I agree with you in that sense. Marijuana, who knows? But I agree that the terrain is changing. It's already changing in ways that we don't fully appreciate because of like the age thing. And I think that that's definitely something I want to cover. And if you're out there and you think about this stuff, I want you to pitch me.
I possibly just said something that was totally wrong, right? About medical marijuana college students. And I don't have to really worry about anyone cashing that check because it's like 112 minutes into a podcast. But you're on Slate every week with a new column, and you're on various other outlets, speaking your mind in real time in a way. I was just watching this weekend the documentary Errol Morris did on Donald Rumsfeld, where he never really says you're lying, but he'll occasionally just like play a clip where he's like, "No one thought Osama bin Laden worked with Saddam Hussein," and it's just like show a clip like. We're at a unique historical period for people to be visibly wrong forever. Do you ever consider like all of these, like I think about like, say like the last month in columns, you had a column about Amazon being a force for good in the market and not being a monopoly. You're making like calls in real time. How do you deal with being wrong?
My favorite example of this is that Ross Douthat, who was my co-author in a book we wrote in 2008 and is also one of my closest friends, we were on a radio program in which we both talked up. You know, we had assumed, oh, this person is probably going to be John McCain's running mate in 2008, but the person would be really awesome would be Sarah Palin. So we actually got out ahead of that. We definitely talked her up very enthusiastically. I don't think that turned out brilliantly. Not everyone is going to share this attitude, and but I'll just tell you the truth, which is what I always strive to do. I think of this as an ongoing conversation. I think of these calls as contingent, and I have, I think, been pretty good about revising the calls that I make on these things. And also, I regret not even so much the calls that I made, but some of the ways that I thought about issues when I was younger. I mean, I've been doing this since I was 21.
You're like the first generation where everything you've ever written will be recallable.
Yeah, like it was all on the web. Actually, some of these places have really crappy web archives.
Yeah, I was going to say your only hope is the architecture of National Review's site.
And that actually is very humbling, because you think, well, if you had that frame of mind at that time, if that's how you were arguing then, you know, how have you changed? And I guess, I don't know if I succeed, but I think very hard about growing and trying to do different things. I mean, taking this role as executive editor is to some degree about, I want to carve out some space to do some longer writing of my own, but I also really want to dedicate myself to cultivating other writers. I mean, it's just important to me. And I think that, you know, I've always thought of myself as a better idea guy than a writer. I mean, I think I'm a solid writer. I'm good at it. You know, I could be better. I hope to get better. But I just love ideas. I love the conversation. I don't mind being proven wrong. I kind of feel like there's certain conversations that happen in the right spirit, where it's kind of like, hey, like, we have a pretty good sense of what our priors are, rather than like the shadow boxing without acknowledging what the priors are. I mean, I kind of feel like it's useful to kind of like, okay, know where we're coming from.
Yeah, full disclosure.
And then kind of, yeah, exactly. And then kind of go from there.
Yeah.
I think that's just more constructive. And I just feel very lucky to get to take part in that. And I think that in a way, when we talk about the web, like, and including the annoying things about the web and the hot takes and what have you, I mean, it is pretty amazing how inclusive it is. Like, it's funny, when Andrew Sullivan started blogging, he was the one political blogger. So when any news event happened, it was like, we're going to go to him.
Yeah.
Whereas now we're saturated with kind of instant reaction, which is actually why I think when you talked about the age of the column, it's kind of why I think we're reentering the age of the column, because now something that feels a little substantial, something that's like, you know, 1,500, 2,000 words that is genuinely analytical, and it's kind of like, let's say, reframing something, I think that actually is quite a relief, because there's such a fire hose of like instant reaction. And so just that added degree of thoughtfulness is actually very attractive. Now, how long that'll be the case, you know, who knows? But
it's, I do
it's
something
think
we talk about
thing.
With regards to long form. People will be like, so what's so good about all these long articles? It's like, well, there's nothing good about them. There's something bad about most 300 word article. There's It's not that there's anything implicitly good about a long article. It's that when you filter the internet at, say, that 1,500 word mark, no one puts in enough work to write like total 1,500 word crap, in my experience. It ups the debate purely by the effort. Just by showing up, you've proven something.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I mean, I have to say, I've written so many columns at this point in my life, it's kind of crazy. But actually, the nice thing with Slate is that I write longer columns for them. And it's nice, and I kind of feel like it's nice to get that pushback. And because I have a real tendency, in fact, they haven't fully beaten it out of me, but I have a real tendency to like not always want to be completely explicit, partly because I don't want to close your mind. Like, I want you to be kind of open to this, so let me not necessarily completely hammer down exactly where, you know, kind of this is coming from. But I think that it's kind of can be constructive, because to some degree I kind of want to feel like I'm actually not being complete.
Right.
Like, I wrote this piece on OkCupid and dating and race and dating. And it was funny because all these people were like, it's not necessarily racist. What if you want to marry someone of your religion? I was like, dude, that definitely occurred to me. And there's a reason I didn't bring it up, because it's your job to bring it up. Right. You know, I want you to talk it out. So anyway, I think that being complete, just complete enough, but not so complete that you're pretending to foreclose conversation, and you're not pretending that this is definitively the last word on the subject.
I'm not surprised to say that you're more of an ideas guy than a writing guy. Not because I think there's any deficiency in your writing, but because I like when I watch you live on the Vice podcast, I can see that you take a certain pleasure in sort of coming off the cuff, like letting ideas come out in real time, and really like there's a certain improvisational thrill to it that is evident in the way that you interview. And I was watching that. This is, of course, my interviewing problem. All I can talk about is like the two things that happened to me in the last week. I was watching the Errol Morris with Donald Rumsfeld. And you can see, because he doesn't cut in a lot of those pieces, a lot of his technique is wait, 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 and then just come right back at it. And he leaves the timing in. So I was, when you had Errol Morris on, I was like, oh man, he has met his match. And yeah. I thought you did quite well. So I'm intrigued, is like, what's going on in your mind when you're trying to sort of work in real time like that? Are you thinking of like the next question? I noticed, I bring this up because this is episode number about 115, and you're my first guest who's taken notes during the interview. And I'm fascinated by what you've written down on that piece of paper.
Well, here I've just written down a couple of names and also just the word persuasion, and then in parentheses the words within and then without. So these are just, I think sometimes that helps me organize my thoughts a bit. And also, I'm kind of obsessed. I've never really kept a diary in any rigorous kind of way, but I am obsessed with like when you've had a day and you're like taking notes throughout the day and then look at it at the end of the day, and how powerful that is. Like what a relief it is to kind of... And I think it's something that can make you feel present, but I generally don't do that with the interviews. It depends on who it is. I mean, there's some people, Molly Crabapple is someone I interviewed, and it just, we are different people. We have different modes of interaction, but it was such a pleasure to hear her unfold these different ideas, to unspool these different ideas, I should say. With some other people, sometimes I feel like they need to be drawn out, and that kind of makes me feel a little bit more like attentive to them, and just kind of like I want to like make them feel safe. So it definitely varies from person to person. But with the idea thing, I mean, I definitely think that I am fundamentally an improviser to a fault. And if anything, like I've really strived to kind of be a little more disciplined about how I do my work. The other idea thing, though, is like, I'm not sure how many of your readers follow this ideological stuff, but there are a number of conservatives, you know, myself included, who've been thinking for many years now about how to change the conservative conversation, how to change how conservatives think about certain policy issues, et cetera. You know, certainly I've been engaged with my writing, but a lot of that's been corralling people, talking to people, getting people who don't know each other to talk to each other. And that is also stuff that I love. And so for me, you know, a magazine was a way of connecting people throughout the country, it still is at its best, with this conversation and inviting them to take part in it. There is the other dimension, and as someone who commissions, there is this insecurity that I find that is really bad for magazine journalism. And I think something that actually I kind of secretly hope that we can capitalize on this, but there's a laziness of magazine editors where they only want to commission things from people who are proven, known quantities. They become so paralyzed by the prestige of their brand that they're like, well, it's violating the traditions of fancy magazine number 6. Yeah. So we can't do that. And then you're like, wow, this is hilarious. So you're literally commissioning things from someone who's written for 7 other places that are like pretty damn similar to you.
Yep.
You're that risk averse. And I think that, you know, the nice thing about us is that's the great thing about being on the fringes.
Yeah.
Like, we have our own institutional weight. We have our own traditions. We take them seriously. But what I'm hoping is that, man, like we can find people, you know, diamonds in the rough. Like, we don't have to worry about that quite as much. We want to honor those traditions, but we are both willing to and have to put in that work to find people who aren't great yet, but who are going to become great, as opposed to just having to be like, oh my God, I know everything this guy's going to say. Like, I know exactly the kind of earnest, you know, kind of like liberal thing I'm going to hear from this person or whatever else. And it's like, you know, that's enervating.
I feel like it's a funny phenomenon in what you described, where I've heard from, I won't say names of magazines, but I've heard from magazines where they'll say like, oh, well, that's not an online piece. That's a magazine piece. And it's like, you're saying that's good though, right? And it's like, oh yeah, it's good. It's like, Are you saying that you're intentionally making the website bad?
That's a whole other kettle
but
of fish.
You described like sort of an idealized version of the magazine as brand, kind of, this is our brand. And the big development, I would say, of the last few years that I've seen is sort of the emergence of the writer brand, where writers are their own brand, or, you know, got to get your own audience, get out on Twitter. So I would describe you as someone who has a very successful brand. Like, a lot of people from disparate backgrounds know about you and know about your writing. You're someone who I think resonates to a wider audience than you have to. What's the future of the Rehan Salaam brand? Like, and how do you regard that in terms of your career and the choices you make?
I think that if I were deliberate about it, it would look pretty different, just in the sense that I think that I have this like unenviable distinction of being someone, a lot of the people who are familiar with the Rehan brand hate the Rehan brand because it's funny. Like, I don't think of myself as that much of a brand. Like, I think of myself as a facilitator. There are a lot of these longer essays I really want to write. There are a lot of kind of more substantial piece of writing I really want to do. And I struggle with that just because I've been writing these columns for so long. It's been the kind of way I think. And so, like, weirdly, going over 2,000 words actually naturally is easy. Like, you're just kind of typing. Yeah. But to kind of think ahead, like, gosh, right. You know, I still feel a little intimidated by it in a funny way. You know, my dream would be to have a setup where, you know, let's say I am able to contribute to an institution I really believe in. You know, National Review is a place where I really support the mission. But then sometimes I joke with friends, like, I would be amazing to be like a game show host and then to also write really long, weighty essays about, you know, how we think about the planet. Just because I think that, you know, there are these two parts of my brain, like, where I just love engaging with people and I love performance. But then also, I do feel like, man, sometimes I think I need to unpack. And, you know, there's so much that's implicit, so much that's unstated in some of my writing to a point that I think can be frustrating. And I just kind of think I'd really like to give it some space and give it the time that it needs.
Well, I wish you success in both the game show hosting and long-form essay writing traditions. That sounds like a properly diversified career, too. Those aren't both going to go out of business at the same time. So thank you very much for coming in, Rehan Salaam. We'll have all the stuff in the show notes. Tell me the name of your book.
Grand New Party.
Grand New Party is the book. There's a Slate column every week, and I assume you're going to be doing some stuff at National Review.
Absolutely.
You know, actually, a great way to follow someone like Rehan is in the long form app, where you could follow him and you'd be getting all the pieces he did on Slate, National Review. You've written, you're like a perfect poster boy for following a writer across domains. So thank you again for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back next week. And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to Rehan Salaam for coming in, though he lives in the neighborhood, so it really was not so hard for him. Thanks to my co-hosts, Evan Ratliff, Max Linsky, our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman, our intern, Rachel Mabe. Thanks to our sponsors, Bonobos, Tiny Letter from MailChimp, and Cards Against Humanity's 10 Days or Whatever of Kwanzaa. That was at holidaybullshit.com. You should go there and check it out. We'll be back here next week.